Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the winter that just won't quit, another monster storm up and way down the eastern seaboard. Republican leader John Boehner takes a gamble and sends up the debt ceiling.
We'll let the Democrats put the votes up. We'll put a minimum number of votes up to get it passed.
The French president comes with no companion to Washington.
Long live the United States. Vive la France. Et vive l'amitié entre la France et les États-Unis.
And could the NFL soon have its first openly gay player?
Came to tell the world that I'm an openly proud gay man.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of CBS News, Laura Mandeville from Le Figaro, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? Does a clean bill on the debt ceiling mean the Tea Party's done? Are you tuned in to Sochi, to Michael Sam? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, Correspondent at Large for National Journal. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also from Washington, Laura Mandeville joins us. She's U.S. Bureau Chief and the Chief U.S. Correspondent for Le Figaro, the French newspaper. She was at the White House state dinner this week for French President Hollande. Laura Mandeville, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Laura.
Laura, you're our French guest today. You were at the state dinner. Did this visit matter? Here comes your poor, lonely president with neither a companion or lover, or you name it. What was at stake in this visit by the French president, Laura?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that our president was lonely, I mean, it was maybe visible, you know, on the marches when he was welcomed at the White House by the Obama couple, really. But yeah. After that, I think that he managed to overcome, you know, this potential, drawback, and the visit actually went pretty well. And at the dinner, you know, once everyone, all the journalists present, were able to see that someone was sitting next to President Obama instead of Valérie Trierweiler, I think the whole story of the scandal was not the main focus, really.
And here's Hollande talking about the European economy, where it was, and now saying it's stronger.
Your call for solidarity and for growth was heard and was extremely useful back then. Since then, Europe has come out of its financial crisis. It now has the relevant instruments for stability, and it has introduced banking union.
The French president interpreted there on Tuesday at a press conference with the president. And here's the president. There have been some rough language from American diplomats lately about the EU, but the president was talking about cooperation.
Our military and intelligence personnel cooperate every day, keeping our nation secure and dealing with crises and challenges from Africa to the Persian Gulf. Our diplomats work side by side to help resolve conflicts and promote peace from Syria to Iran.
Laura Mandeville, we heard that diplomat on tape, courtesy, I guess, of Russians listening in, perhaps, and releasing it to the world, saying, bleep the EU. Is there a problem in relations between Washington and France, the EU, Laura?
Well, I think there are lots of, you're touching upon different topics here. I mean, there is, on the one hand, I think, a pretty extraordinary reversal of a situation in the Franco-American relationship, and that cannot be denied, you know, after witnessing what happened this week. I think the Franco-American relationship is extremely vibrant and strong, especially on the security level. You know, I think the Americans, after the very high tensions of the 10 years ago, you know, with the Freedom Fries and France refusing to participate in the Iraq adventure, have come to recognize that the French can be wise partners. You know, maybe they were actually right about Iraq, and that they are, you know, sort of ready to take on many challenges, especially in Africa and the Sahel. And I think the Americans are very, you know, sort of grateful for that because they can't take the burden on these crises. At the same time, of course, there are lots of irritants in which are actually pretty normal. I mean, you have the huge irritant which came out of the NSA civilian scandal. And but I think on that particular one, actually, France is maybe much less vocal, for instance, than Germany. You know, I think the French value the intelligence cooperation with the U.S. more than they want to say, you know, in public. So they were very indignant and vocal at the beginning. But now I am struck by the fact that François Hollande was extremely, you know, sort of mild in the way he talked about the NSA surveillance program. And talking about the EU, the story you're referring to with Victoria Nuland, I think it was a really... actually, a pretty revealing of the strong tensions that probably exist between the U.S. and the EU on how to tackle the Ukrainian question. And I think it sort of raises a wider question about what do we do with Russia in Ukraine? I think we've probably not come up with a good solution on this one.
Laura, stand by. I want to come back to you on Syria and Ukraine, Russia, where I know you spend a lot of time. Let me bring it back to Washington and Capitol Hill for a minute. Major Garrett, a big step this week when John Boehner brought just enough votes to the table to get a clean bill through on the debt ceiling. This has been the battle line for years now. This has been the Tea Party issue, the American debt, and Boehner talking tough here but letting it go through. Here he was on Tuesday saying he'd offer the minimum number of votes to pass the debt ceiling. He was laying it on the president and Democrats here, but it was his votes that put it over. Here's Boehner.
It's the president driving up the debt, and the president wanting to do nothing about the debt that's occurring, will not engage in our long-term spending problem, and so let his party give him the debt ceiling increase that he wants.
Democrats welcoming this, here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
I commend Speaker Boehner for doing the right thing. He voted for this and got enough Republican votes to get it done. I'm pleased that he has come to the realization that the full faith and credit of this country is not hostage to be held for political gain.
Major, I know you're watching from the White House now, but give us the best play-by-play you can here. What's the calculation? Why did this go through as a clean bill? Why did John Boehner let it happen now?
Because he didn't have the votes to do anything else, Tom. This has been a long, unraveling surrender by House Republicans to use the extension of debt purchasing by the government to finance existing spending and existing obligations, to exert on the president political pressure to get concessions out of him. The president has made it clear he's not going to engage in any negotiations. Before Speaker Boehner handed this over essentially to House Democrats to vote it over with a few Republican votes, he tried a couple of alternatives with House Republicans, say, will you vote for this? And not enough for House Republicans would vote for it. So Speaker Boehner had one tactical option left. He knew he had to surrender, and he knew that the debt ceiling would have to be extended. So the only tactical place he could find to help his party was to have as few Republicans vote for this as possible, so they would encounter the least amount of midterm political blowback from their own Republican constituents. It wasn't the best hand to deal with by far. It exacted nothing from the White House. It gave in completely on the idea of using the debt ceiling as a tool to advance Republican budgetary priorities. But in one tactical respect, by having the vast majority of votes for this come from Democrats and not Republicans, the one thing Boehner did was he protected Republicans from aggravated Republicans in their home district saying, why did you vote for this?
Protected a lot of them, had just enough to get it across. Of course, a lot of those who didn't vote for it, saying they don't want it, they didn't want it. Here's Sean Duffy, Congressman Republican from Wisconsin, talking with Fox News. He didn't vote for the clean bill on the debt ceiling hike.
I didn't vote for it. I think if we're going to raise the debt limit, we have to reform the way we spend. Democrats won't vote for a debt limit increase unless it's clean. So listen, this is not getting the job done. We have to have more bipartisan buy-in to figure out how we get our country to a point of balance. But we're on a pathway to a train wreck fiscally in this country.
Major Garrett, could this be marking a high watermark for Tea Party influence on Capitol Hill? I mean, after all, last fall, the answer was shut down the government.
Well, one of the more interesting conversations that's going on within House Republican ranks and Senate Republican ranks, for that matter, is when you've been shown with the shutdown, with the other debt ceiling confrontations, that you don't have the votes to change the will of the democratically controlled Senate or a democratically reelected president of the United States, what are your options? Do you fight and continue to shut down the government, to continue to have these spectacles over the debt ceiling, injecting unnecessary instability into the U.S. economy? Or do you live to fight another day and minimize these issues, protect your ranks, and hope to gain seats in the Senate in the midterm elections and maybe even in the House to enlarge your numbers to have a better chance of setting all these issues up for a later debate? Mostly where Republicans have come down on this after these very intense and largely unsuccessful political fights before is to wait to fight another day. And the most interesting conversation happening among Republicans is, are Tea Party-inspired Republicans and establishment Republicans, if not agreeing on all of the issues, at least agreeing under the underlying tactics? And I think the votes this week indicate that they are.
Jack, we've got you up against the clock here, I'm sorry, but what do you see in Boehner's move this week and the debt ceiling up?
Well, the budget wars seem to be over for now, but the paralysis on economic policy is apt to continue. Janet Yellen was asked this week, the new Fed chair, what has been the cost to the economy of the mismatch between an accommodative Federal Reserve on monetary policy and an budget cuts and tax increases on the fiscal side? She said 1.5% of growth. The economy could be 1.5% bigger were it not for that mismatch, were it not for A, the Tea Party cuts, and B, the Obama tax cuts.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news: snowy South, sunny Sochi, debt ceiling lifted, another Obamacare delay, and the French president comes visiting. Laure Mandeville joins us, U.S. Bureau Chief, Chief U.S. Correspondent for Le Figaro, the French newspaper. She was at the state dinner for President Hollande this week. Major Garrett's here, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. And Jack is here, of course, Jack Beatty's here, of course, all kinds of snow in the South. Here's a resident of Russellville, Arkansas, talking with CNN about his issues just getting to work on Wednesday.
I've been sliding everywhere, and I even got hot oil tires, and it's still just late.
Up and down and all around, Americans dealing with a lot of snow in the South, and then those very sunny slopes in Sochi melting as the snowmaking machines worked overtime to keep everything slipping and sliding and skiing and snowboarding there. Major Garrett, I want to come to you on a couple of things about Obamacare. One, the latest numbers, 1 million-plus signing up in January, still a little behind where they wanted to be, but that was a big push of subscribers, I guess, coming in. At the same time, the employer mandate being pushed out again by the Obama administration. What's going on here, Major?
Well, as everyone knows, Tom, there are many tentacles to Obamacare and many different stories. Let's just take them in order. The enrollment numbers for the month of January, just announced, indicate 1 million-plus, 3.3 million total in the enrollment period. The period to enroll extends until March 15th. It was the best month by far, and certainly the one that showed the largest uptick in the Americans 18 to 34, the most desirable because they're perceived to be younger and healthier by the insurance companies.
Yep.
Signing up, that's all to the good. But still, Tom, there are so many things from a data perspective we don't know about what these numbers actually mean. Let me just give you two quick examples. We don't know how many people have actually paid for their coverage, and we don't know how many people of this 3.3 million were uninsured before. For the underlying economics of Obamacare to function over the long haul, you need to pull the uninsured into the insurance market, draft them in, if you will.
Yeah.
And what it appears is a lot of these people who have enrolled had insurance before. They're just choosing different plans with subsidies or other inducements from the Affordable Care Act. And until the government can actually tease out these numbers and tell us and tell the insurance companies how many people are in who were never in the system before, and how many have actually paid and are continuing to pay, the underlying economics of the Affordable Care Act remain unknown.
Major, let me just ask you on that front. I understand nationally, holistically, overall, it's about getting the uninsured insured. But for the viability of the Affordable Care Act itself, isn't it just raw numbers that matter? Does it matter if they had insurance before and now they've shifted over here? For the viability, isn't it just the number that counts?
The number doesn't count, Tom. I've had so many conversations with healthcare experts here at the White House. I mean, in one respect, if you have 7 million, which was the original projection from the Congressional Budget Office, that's probably going to be good. But even with 7 million, what you need is a mix, and you need a lot of the uninsured to be in the marketplace, and you need on a state level and across the country and an aggregate basis a lot of young uninsured or young healthy Americans who are less likely to take money out of the system and much more likely to put money into the system, meaning they're paying premiums, but they're not taking out a lot in their own health care needs in terms of coverage. And those ratios are very important. The ratios, many healthcare experts have told me, are in fact more important than the aggregate number, because if the ratios are mismatched, if you still don't have enough of the young and relatively healthy as compared to the older and sicker, the underlying economics become quite wobbly.
Major, hold it there for a second. There's more to look at here, but let's just stick with the numbers. And Jack Beatty, let me bring it to you. The White House expressing a lot of happiness about these greater numbers coming in, a million plus in January. Major says, well, yes, but.
Yes, but you know, and imagine what the White House would be saying. Imagine the tone. It would even be more eupeptic. If the week didn't start with the delay in yet another mandate, the 13th time the Obama has asked for waivers or delays or changes in the Affordable Care Act, and that gave the Republicans a talking point that they're going to continue to press. I mean, the main issue here, you know, the policy issues are just as complicated as Major laid out, but the political issues are the headlines. The headline of January good, on track, perhaps even to meet the 7 million mark by March, that's all good for the Democrats. On the other hand, delays for companies with 50 to 90 employees, that mandate has been waived until January 16th. Deadline for bigger companies to provide insurance used to be 7. You know, was required to be 95% full by 2015. Now just 70%. That just gives the impression of this law as you know, a great improvisation. And it feeds the Republican line, which I don't know the constitutional arguments that, you know, the president is usurping power. Now, when you look into that, it doesn't sound as if he is. There's a 1984 Supreme Court case that gives the executive power, discretion to fill in ambiguous gaps in the law. The Treasury Department says we're acting within the law. We are not preventing the, you know, we're not stopping implementation. We're slowing it so that it doesn't hurt taxpayers, doesn't hurt small businesses, and of course, they're not saying doesn't hurt Democrats running for re-election.
Well, I don't know if the language is ambiguous here. I mean, it was supposed to go into effect last month. It got pushed out a year, and now to 2015, and now to 2016. And this is the employer mandate. Employers with 50 to 99 employees were supposed to be required to have coverage for those employees. The Obama administration is calling this transition relief. Here's the president talking about it on Tuesday with the French president at his side.
This was an example of administratively us making sure that we're smoothing this transition, giving people the opportunities to get right with the law, but recognizing that there are going to be circumstances in which people are trying to do the right thing and it may take a little bit of time. Our goal here is not to punish folks.
Sounds benign, but Republicans were all over it, saying this is failing, this is political. Here's Senator John Thune, South Dakota Republican.
The president clearly made, again, a decision that was based upon two factors. One is economic factor. By delaying the employee mandate for some employers or employer mandate for some employers, he made a decision based upon the fact that the employer mandate is going to hurt the economy. And he made a political decision because he knows that the political outlook for Democrats this fall, based upon their vote for Obamacare, was looking increasingly bleak.
Laura Mandeville with Le Figaro, I want to get your perspective on how all this American health care debate looks to a French or European observer. But first, Major Garrett, on this new a change in the rollout schedule. Who's got right on their side here, Major?
Well, look, the president can exert his executive authority to, as he said, smooth out the law at his discretion. And until there is a countervailing Supreme Court case that alters the precedent that Jack mentioned in that 84 case, he's going to continue to do that. I think it's instructive what the president said in that soundbite we just heard. We don't want to punish folks. If you pick that apart, as I did in my column at National Journal earlier this week, there's only one conclusion you can draw. The president is saying the application of his law on time constitutes punishment. Those are not my words. Those are the president's words. And when he talks about smoothing this out, he's saying the law as drafted and as it was going to be implemented was going to be placing an undue burden on employers. Well, that suggests an internal flaw with the law itself and its real-world application, which does reinforce the political discussion that has been visited upon the Affordable Care Act, and I guarantee you will be visited upon it all of this election year. And not just because it's an election year, but because this is a real-world law encountering real-world health insurance, much of it dysfunctional before the law. It is having its own reactionary dysfunction as the law is implemented, and the White House is trying to adjust as best it can. There are political realities here. It is no coincidence this disease delay was announced early in a midterm election year when Democratic anxieties about gaining any ground in the House have basically diminished, and anxiety about losing control of the democratically controlled Senate are now rising. These things are all coming together, policy and politics, and there is no way a Democrat seeking re-election in this midterm election can run away from the Affordable Care Act. The president's trying to make the process of living with it as easy as possible.
You've written, no one has been more aggressive about delaying and defanging Obamacare than Obama himself. Politically, Major, was requiring these employers with 40 to 99 employees, not such small businesses, to have health insurance so politically threatening to Democrats running, looking at elections this fall?
Everything is at the margins, Tom. And at the marginal level, if there is 5 to 6% shift or dissatisfaction or larger negative publicity about the confrontation of businesses of mid-size, 50 to 99, encountering this law, at the margins, Democrats would prefer not to have to live with that. Now, there's also a good deal of evidence here at the White House that those medium-sized businesses and those that spoke up for them lobbied the administration very hard for an extra year. And I would bring up one last point. There might be someone who works for a company of this size who said, under the law, I'm supposed to get coverage next year. The president said, I no longer am going to receive that coverage, even though the law said I'm entitled to it.
Yeah.
I'm not predicting this, but it seems possible that that employee, if they wanted to, could sue the federal government over this alteration in the law saying, my standing as someone who was supposed to get health care has now been jeopardized. That law should have been implemented as written. You might see a court challenge there as well.
That would be interesting. Laura Mandeville, U.S. Bureau Chief for Le Figaro. Here we are in the middle of this epic debate in the United States about reforming our health care system, going on for years. You've been watching it. What do you make of all this? As a French European observer of Americans grappling with this uniquely American structure and problem, Laura?
Well, I think it's an absolutely fascinating debate for a European and a French observer because it's like being on a different planet, frankly, because I think in France, and not only in France, but in most European countries, the question of the role of government in ensuring universal healthcare coverage is not in debate. I mean, it has been established decades ago when even Britain, which has a model which is close to the American one, the Anglo-Saxon economy, would never give up on their national health service. And it's like a holy cow, and it's the same in France. So we are understanding it's a choice, that the government is ensuring health care for everyone. And it's true that for us it's bewildering when I hear people telling me that they don't have health care coverage, mm-hmm. and they have to pay this huge amount of money if suddenly they get in trouble. So seeing the whole debate has been absolutely amazing, and what I see that the whole Obama presidency has actually been busy with this question, the whole first term, and now it's like an albatross hanging on his neck and endangering, as Major Garrett extremely explained very well, endangering his second term, frankly.
Let's go to Jane, calling from Braintree, Massachusetts. Jane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say that the talk about the French president coming without his girlfriend is so much pap. It's just
enough already, you say, Jane. Who cares?
Enough already. It doesn't belong on the radio. The other issue I wanted to make, and I know I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but the gay football player,
Michael Sam, out of Missouri. Yes, defensive lineman.
Yeah. Who cares? Who cares whether he's gay, transgender, straight, whatever? He plays the game. He wins the game. That's all that's important. I think so much has been made about that fellow who is gay, and who cares? I just don't think it's news. I think the news is Syria. The news is the economy, and that's what I love to hear on, well, your gospel. This program, as far as I'm concerned, is just gospel.
Jane, we've got it on both fronts. Let the French president travel alone or with a companion however he likes. And Michael Sam, you say, who cares? It's interesting. I want to play a little. This is a take a few seconds here to hear out, but this is interesting. This is a longtime Dallas sportscaster down in Texas, Dale Hansen. This is tape of him ripping into pro football executives after Michael Sam came out as gay. This is the Missouri college player, a likely draft for the NFL. Dallas sportscaster Dale Hansen came out and said, hey, let's think twice about this. Here's Dale Hansen out of Texas.
Michael Sam would be the first openly gay player in the NFL, says he knows there will be problems and they've already started. Several NFL officials telling Sports Illustrated it will hurt him on draft day because a gay player wouldn't be welcome in an NFL locker room. It would be uncomfortable because that's a man's world. You beat a woman and drag her down a flight of stairs, pulling her hair out by the roots, you're the fourth guy taken in the NFL draft. You kill people while driving drunk, that guy's welcome. Players caught in hotel rooms with illegal drugs and prostitutes, we know they're welcome. Players accused of rape and pay the woman to go away. You lie to police trying to cover up a murder, we're comfortable with that. You love another man, well, now you've gone too far.
Dallas sportscaster Dale Hansen. Major Garrett, what do you think? If Michael Sam steps up for the draft, do you think he'll sail right in, and will we have the first out NFL player?
Well, Tom, I'm closer to the story than you might think. I'm a graduate of the University of Missouri. I'm a huge booster. Anyone who follows me on Twitter knows of my love for my alma mater. And I don't know Michael Sam well, but I know many people attached to the University of Missouri athletic program and the football team. I think this is a big story. I disagree with the previous caller because the NFL is the biggest sports enterprise on planet Earth. It is a incubator, if you will, for American social change. It is a reflection of our culture and its evolution. And Michael Sam has taken a very great risk by announcing this before the NFL combine and before he is drafted. And the thing that strikes me about this story is two things. One, he told his Missouri Tiger teammates in August. The Missouri Tigers had their best season ever in the SEC, and Michael Sam performed exceptionally well on the football field. It was a bit of an issue for his teammates, but the leadership culture there proved to me that it can succeed at a college level in very tough games, and it can succeed at the pro level if the organization commits itself to diversity and acceptance. And to the other point, I think the NFL has to ask itself a couple of things raised by the Dallas sportscaster. What are all these other things the NFL turns either a blind eye to or sweeps under the rug that have nothing to do with the human expression of love, that has nothing to do with the locker room or the football field? And when you have other forms of criminality that are either brushed aside or dealt with casually, and this becomes an issue, then the mirror that the NFL often holds up to our larger society needs to be turned around.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the popular smartphone app game Flappy Bird was pulled off the market by its developer, Dong Yun, partly because he thought the game was just too addictive. Woo, addicted yet? Comedian Sid Caesar died at 91. In the 1950s, he launched TV's first live comedy, Your Show of Shows.
Most of my material comes from life. What happened to me, what happened to other people that I saw. So people understand what I'm doing. It's not just off the wall.
And Shirley Temple, black, child actress known for her curls, her Depression-era movies, and her later career as a diplomat, died this week at 85. Here she was, 6 years old, 1934.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay.
We're looking at a week in the news with Major Garrett of CBS News, Chief White House Correspondent there, Laure Mandeville, U.S. Bureau Chief for Le Figaro, the French newspaper, and Jack Beattie. Doris is calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Doris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the Mike Sam discussion.
Sure.
And I've noticed that, a week or so ago at the beginning of the Olympics, we sent Billie Jean King and Guy Botano, and they were in the headlines about protesting Russia's law regarding homosexuality.
Yes.
That it was illegal. And yet, within a week, we have Mike Sam, and we have NFL coaches and some people saying he does not belong. Isn't this a little bit hypocritical?
That's interesting, Jack. You know, here we send our symbolic protest to Vladimir Putin, and then we have maybe a big debate at home. We'll see how big it becomes. Unresolved in the U.S., Jack.
Yes, indeed. And there's no room here for triumphalism. At the same time, we can apply the very same standards we apply critically to us, to Russia, and say that this law is intolerable, the Russian effort to stigmatize people's sexual identity. You know, this is a real Jackie Robinson moment for gay rights, for human dignity. And I think that this young man, as you read about him, his background, one of eight children born in Hitchens, Texas. Three of his siblings died before him. Two killed. One certainly shot breaking into a house. Two others in jail. His only hope was sports. He said, "I needed sports to make sure I didn't get into trouble." And he through his own will, made himself this fantastic athlete with no support at all from his family. His mother didn't want him to do it from religious grounds. His father had moved out, and he moved in. He was sort of adopted by a local family, actual banker. It sounds like a subplot from Friday Night Lights. And made himself into this stellar athlete. So you do have the sort of Jackie Robinson personality of the persevering athlete going now against a culture in the NFL that seems to be based on what people say, a good deal of homophobia. But it will change. No one can doubt it will change. And as others have said, he's by no means the first. He will be by no means the first gay athlete in the NFL.
Though it would be the first openly. So, Laure Mandeville, what about Russia and the Sochi Games? You were a correspondent in Russia for Le Figaro for a long time. You're watching how this is all unfolding. How do you think Vladimir Putin's ultimately doing, his Russia doing with these games, Laure?
Well, I've been watching from far from here, mm-hmm. you know, how it's going on. But I think that so far, you know, the games are going pretty well. You know, all the fears and criticism around the Sochi have appeared mainly, you know, not confirmed. No real security problem for now. An absolutely stunning opening of the games, very beautiful. I think, you know, which hasn't been so much stressed, I think, in the U.S., but for myself, I thought, you know, being a big admirer of Russian culture, I thought this opening was absolutely magnificent and a beautiful, a description of Russian history. But, of course, at the same time, it is also a tool in the hands of Vladimir Putin, who is a leader extremely authoritarian, and who is trying to demonstrate through Sochi that Russia is back, and also that he has restored the country to its rightful place. That actually, the political system he's been building is the right one. That's what he's trying to do. And so there is actually a difficult approach for the West with these games, because on the one hand, they should recognize somehow, you know, the Russian, I think, pretty normal pride of hosting these games, which goes much beyond Vladimir Putin, and have a lot of Russian friends who are, you know, watching and are proud of these games. But at the same time, of course, we have to make sure that this doesn't that we state what is behind this sort of village, Potemkin village, Sochi to a certain extent is a facade, and behind you have a absence of rule of law, an extremely ruthless regime to political opposition, and many, many other things.
And of course, in the end, Billie Jean King did not attend. Her mother was sick and actually died. The biggest non-sporting story out of Sochi really seems to have been that incredibly warm weather this week, people skiing in practically halter tops there down the slopes above Sochi. Carl in Madison, Wisconsin's is calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I would like to talk about our crazy weather. For those who have been wondering why there's been record cold in American heartland and snowstorms in Atlanta, if our globe is actually warming, you know, folks tossing off "Where's global warming now?" one-liners, they might want to pay attention to the work of climatologist Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University and others who've been focusing on rapidly warming Arctic as the culprit behind our freezing temperatures. Professor Francis suggests that because carbon in the atmosphere has caused the Arctic to warm at a rate considerably faster than here in the States, the reduction in the temperature differential between the Earth's north and south of the jet stream has caused the jet stream to really slow down. And just like you turn the hose down to a trickle and watch it dribble down the driveway, this jet stream is meandering so far off course, it's diving far south to bring polar temperatures to my state of Wisconsin. I mean, recently my thermometer was 18 below zero, the wind chill was 40 below zero, and at the very same moment, balmy temperatures on either side of this loop of, you know, this river of wind were bringing temperatures in New York up into the 50s that day, and that's a 70-degree temperature differential. Yeah,
Carl, you and a lot of other people watching all this crazy weather and wondering what's historical and what is a sign that we are in new territory. Major Garrett, do you have a sense of the country looking at all this weather? Weather gets so much attention now. It gets bigger drama treatment in my watching anyway than it used to, that's related to the background fear, which maybe should be foreground, that this is climate change chewing in on us, Major.
Yeah, I think there is something to be said for that, Tom. There are times, I must admit, and perhaps those who are kind enough to employ me at CBS will not treat this next comment all too kindly, but I think there are times in the media we overemphasize the weather. We sort of fall in love with the ease of the weather story and the visuals of either snowfalls or hurricanes and all that other stuff.
Yep.
But I do think there is an underlying backbeat, if you will, intellectually, politically, and economically about what does this all mean and how should we as a society wrestle with it. I just wish we would spend more time on that debate than live shots in front of snowdrifts or hurricane wind blasts.
NPR doing a lot with that in the last weekend, and I'm glad to see it. I mean, these are whatever you think, these are the biggest, most serious issues planet-wise that we can think about. On the other side, or not quite the other side, but far around the planet, unbelievable scenes out of homes in Syria this week. Talks have not gone very well on the peace front, but there was just enough of a ceasefire to get some aid in there and some people out. CNN here was talking with the World Food Program's Matthew Hollingworth on Tuesday in homes when the ceasefire was brokered, reporting on the dire, dire scene there.
In terms of what you're seeing inside the city, nobody is living a normal life today. Nobody is able to actually feed themselves, feed their children, feed their families with anything but the weed, the grass that they can pick on the sides of the curb, and what little that they can eke out from what they've saved over time.
Just terrible scenes coming out of Syria, and they have been for such a long time now. Laura Mandeville with Le Figaro, what about these talks that have been going on in Switzerland? Are they a joke? Is something happening there? Is Syria just continuing to fester and suffer?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the picture of these talks and the picture of Syria is extremely bleak and dramatic, and the problem at the talks at the moment is that, you know, it's a dialogue between people who don't want to talk, actually, because on the one hand you have the government of Syria which is talking about, you know, a necessity to quell violence and terrorism. And on the other side, you have the opposition, which wants to talk about creating a full transitional governmental body without the Assad government participating. So at the moment, you know, there is a paralysis because the Syrians, the government, Syrian government and the Russia are refusing a two-track talks on these two different topics. And so what we saw, you know, on Tuesday when Obama and Hollande were giving a press conference was the fact that they expressed openly a huge frustration because, you know, they were praising the Franco-American couple, but the Franco-American couple was unable to do what was necessary to stop this Syrian disaster, you know, back in August. And so here we are, you know, sort of showing impotence in this regard.
Interesting story in Tennessee unfolding just in this couple of days. A move there by the UAW to bring union representation to a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. Now, Volkswagen seems to be on board with this. They're looking for something like a German-style work council, more cooperative relationship, but UAW wants some standing to have in that. Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Haslam talked about that with the editorial board of the Tennessean this week, describing the conversations he's had with Volkswagen.
I've been fairly outspoken. I think it's a negative. And, you know, people say, well, you're just a Republican that doesn't like unions. What I've told them is our concerns are your long-term objectives. You've been saying you need to cut the cost of producing a vehicle and you want a better supply network close to you. And I'm not certain how the UAW helps either one of those.
Jack Beatty, interesting picture here. Right-to-work state. It's drawn a lot of manufacturing into the South. But now you have a European auto manufacturer there signaling that they're open to this. And the governor and others saying no.
No, and you've got the European automaker citing it on economic grounds, that it makes for more efficiency, adaptability, cooperation. They point to Germany's experience through weathering this recession, and they said this can help us do the same thing here. You know, it's a historic moment, really, for unions in the South, not just auto unions, but also nationally. In 1946, Walter Reuther had a famous campaign. He was the head of the UAW, called Open the Books. He said to General Motors, let us on the board. We'll see what your real bottom line is, and we'll decide or decide with you how much you can charge for cars, because we don't want to pass on inflation to the consumer. Well, that went on. That big fight went on for a couple of years, and finally the UAW gave up on that, and they just went back to the Samuel Gompers philosophy of more. All we want is more. Well, this is different. This is back to Reuther. This is back to that moment when American labor can become a partner with management in productivity, in enhancing worker achievement and satisfaction, in making us more competitive. And it would be a shame if this goes down because of all the associated possibilities with it, I think.
Well, so you say. I mean, plenty of opposition there in some quarters. In Tennessee, certainly, there's a vote going on there this week. We'll see how that turns out. Another big business deal this week, in the offing at least, Major. Comcast saying, we're ready to make this $45 billion acquisition of Time Warner Cable. It would create a huge cable company with a lot of media influence in this country. Is it clear if the Obama administration will green light this, Major, or might they put up resistance to it?
Well, there's no real clearance on that or visibility on that yet, Tom. It's just announced, and the fact-gathering process has only just begun. And I am by no stretch of the imagination a telecommunications economics expert. I work in the industry, but that's as far as my expertise goes. I would just say that the thing that strikes me about our industry generally, television, broadcasting, cable's under stress now in ways that it hasn't been in about 30 years, maybe since the advent of the industry itself, because more and more people are finding alternatives to that cable box in their own home.
Yep.
And consuming content offline entirely. That's a stressful situation for cable companies. It's also a stressful situation for broadcast networks, because both have to figure out a way, either through licensing of that product or the commercials injected within that content, to make money. How this merger proposed affects all that economics, I don't know. But it strikes me that It's an attempt to consolidate an industry that is under great stress, and maybe that's the only way that Comcast believes it can function in the future.
A very interesting story. We're going to look more at that Comcast Time Warner Cable story on Monday in this hour. Under stress, people cutting the cord at the same time, they've come up with a $45 billion offer for Time Warner. If that's stress, that's still a lot of cash to offer our stock, as it may be. Jack, we didn't even get to Attorney General Eric Holder saying to states, hey, let's lift the ban on felons voting. It's cutting too many people out of American democracy. Do you see states ready to respond to the Attorney General, Jack?
Not Republican-led states. It's really part of their electoral model. Keep felons from voting and give us, what, in Florida, several hundred thousand votes they don't have to worry about. So I think that's a hard push for the administration.
We'll be watching that space more immediately, still watching those Olympics in Sochi. Glad to have all of you with us today. Laura Mandeville with Le Figaro. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura.
Thank you.
Major Garrett, always great to have you. Thanks for being here, Major.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.